Session number 11745. Repeat. Accession number 11745. Sir Hugh Mackenzie, reel 1.
Admiral Mackenzie, Reel 1. Could we start off with the outbreak of war, please? And could you tell me in what capacity you were acting then?
In the summer of 39, I was a lieutenant and serving at Fort Blockhouse, Gosport, as first lieutenant of a reserve group of submarines, which consisted of the Oswald and Osiris. When mobilization took place in August, these two submarines were brought forward from reserve and commissioned largely with a crew of reservists. And I found myself as first lieutenant of Osiris. We stored for war about the third week in August, which involved taking on board torpedoes with warheads and a full outfit of stores. And we then sailed for the Mediterranean. On the 3rd of September, when war broke out, we were actually approaching Malta and were just north of the island of Pantelleria. Of course, Italy didn't come into the war till later, and so all was peace and quiet, and we arrived in Malta next day. To find that the then first submarine flotilla based in Malta, which consisted largely of S-boats, had left for home waters. And so we were virtually the only submarine left in the Mediterranean. We were subsequently joined by Oswald from the reserve group, and Osiris and Oswald held the fort in the Mediterranean for the next 6 months. It was a frustrating and boring period. We spent most of our time acting as clockwork mice for the surface ships of the Mediterranean fleet in their anti-submarine training, and alternated between Alexandria and Malta. Although occasionally life was enlivened by doing a patrol off the Dardanelles to check on contraband shipping that might be going through the straits there. Part of my frustration was knowing that most of my contemporaries were in submarines in home waters and had started to really fight the war and were already suffering losses in home waters. And I felt very much that we were left out of it, and I longed to get back into a more operational role. Perhaps I should also say at this time that maybe this 6 months of virtual phony war was a blessing in disguise, for at least it enabled us to train ourselves for a wartime role.
You mean you were ill-equipped for a wartime role before September 39?
I would like to elaborate on that a bit. Right up until the outbreak of war, I've always maintained that the British submarine service was very poorly trained for wartime operations. As an example of this, in fleet exercises and other forms of training, submarines were not allowed to dive at night. They had to surface at sunset, switch on their navigation lights, and take no further part in the exercise or operation until daylight the next day. Well, this gave us a completely false outlook on how one should conduct an operational patrol in wartime. And the whole tempo of our existence really didn't prepare us for the dangers that one had to face if you were going to go into enemy-controlled waters on an operational patrol in wartime. As I was saying, this sort of 6 months breathing space in the Mediterranean gave us a chance to pick up hints and tips of what was happening in home waters and prepare ourselves for the outbreak of war in the Mediterranean when Italy came into the war in June 1940. By then, the submarine strength in the Mediterranean had been reinforced with submarines of the same class, that is the O, P and R classes, from the 4th Flotilla in China, together with their depot ship, the Medway. These submarines were not by any means ideal for the rather close and restricted waters of the Mediterranean. As their rate of loss proved fairly rapidly after Italy came into the war. Anyway, war having broken out, Osiris went off on her first operational patrol, which as far as I remember was in the Aegean, and we didn't see very much. We then had a period in Malta where we experienced a certain amount of high-level bombing from the Italian Air Force, not very effective on the dockyard. We then had a patrol in the Adriatic, which I always felt was almost the submariner's dream, because there was a constant flow of shipping between the south of Italy and Albania to prosecute the war in Greece, with targets galore. We were not very successful in Osiris, but we did succeed in sinking the first Italian warship of the war, a destroyer called the Palestro, I think, which was escorting a convoy of small ships which we attacked with torpedoes. Our torpedoes ran under the merchant ships and hit the destroyer at the other, on the other side, quite fortuitously. We also sank one merchant ship by gunfire in the middle of the night. That really was the sum of my operational experience in Osiris, for shortly after that I was sent home from Alexandria, a long voyage round the Cape, to take my commanding officer's qualifying course at Blockhouse.
I've read that in the Norway campaign the Germans had a great deal of problems from their destroyers with their torpedoes. Were there any technical problems with British torpedoes acting in combat at that stage of the war?
We had a certain troubles with the gyro that guided the Marquet torpedo, and every now and then we would get a gyro failure which caused the torpedo to circle. And it's rather unpleasant if you heard this torpedo suddenly turning round and coming back at you yourself instead of going straight to the target. And of course you could always avoid it by diving deep and getting underneath it, because you knew it was running at a fairly shallow depth. But it was an unnerving experience, and of course didn't give you a chance of hitting the enemy. Later on, when I went back to the Mediterranean in 1941, and I'll come on to that later on, there was an acute shortage of modern torpedoes in the Mediterranean, and I actually went on patrol in 1941 with a mixed bag of Mark 8 torpedoes, Mark 4 torpedoes, and Mark 2 torpedoes, date of manufacture 1913. This didn't make it easy always to attack the right targets.
Were they useful or useless?
Well, they had much smaller. The Mark IV had a smaller warhead than the Mark VIII, and the Mark II had a much smaller warhead and was much slower. And I don't think I ever actually fired a Mark II in action. But I'll come back to that later on. I said earlier that the OP and R class were not particularly suited to wartime operations in the Mediterranean, and their losses were very heavy indeed. But Osiris, in fact, survived until the end of the war, although she was chronically sick from defects in her diesel engines, and never achieved very much after that, after 1940-41. In fact, when I was in her for those first few months of the war, we had constant trouble with the diesels and were always having to go into dock or dockyard to have them repaired.
What did you think of the quality of Italian anti-submarine work in 1940?
Well, I never really experienced it. By that token, it wasn't very good. Shall I move on then?
Yes, please.
I got home to England in December 1940, and started my commanding officer's qualifying course in January. I remember well arriving in Portsmouth the night after one of the big blitzes with unexploded bombs still going off all over the city, and one very large one went off just as I got out of the train. So this was my first experience, really, of what had been happening at home over the previous 6 months and the bombing, the German bombing campaign on England. There was nothing very much to say about my training club, my course for command. There were six of us on it, five or six of us on it. We were all of much the same age. We were all looking forward to getting our own commands in war. A month was spent at Blockhouse, and then a month up at Rothsay on the Clyde, based on the old Dipper ship Cyclops. And we all got through the course successfully, and of course hoped that we would get immediate commands. This wasn't always the case, and one had to wait. But I've always remembered the final exhortation by the Captain SM of the training flotilla at Rothsay, Sluggy Edwards, he was called. And in his final exhortation to us, he said, "Remember, knowledge is the key to life." And that's about all he did say to us. But I felt it was particularly pertinent to a budding submarine CO, because the more he knew of what the enemy tactics were and enemy behavior and enemy conduct of operations, not only would he have a greater chance of success or successful patrols, but also a greater chance of survival. And I certainly set myself from then on to learn as much as I could about what the enemy would be likely to do in any given circumstances.
How did you find that out?
By reading every patrol report of every other submarine that had been on patrol that I could lay my hands on, and talking to other submarine COs and questioning them on what they did and what they found and so on. And I've always believed, actually all through my life, that you never stop learning. There is always something new to find out, as a general principle. Having completed my the commanding officer's qualifying course, I found myself as a spare CO hanging about waiting for a job. And the first one I was given was, at a moment's notice, I was sent down to Campbelltown, the south end of the Clyde, to take command of H-31, and take her over to Londonderry while her proper captain went down to Buckingham Palace to receive a gong. He was a very old friend of mine, and there was no trouble over anything like that. And I successfully took H-31 across to Londonderry and berthed her there. The next day we prepared to go to sea to provide AS training for some of the escort forces based on Londonderry. But unfortunately, on our way downriver, at about 6 o'clock in the morning in the dark, we met an incoming Burns Laird cargo ship on its routine run from Glasgow to Londonderry. It failed to see us, and we just avoided being cut in two by it, but only by running into it ourselves instead of it hitting us. So we ended up with a rather crumpled bow and had to go off to Belfast to be docked and repaired. Fortunately, my old friend, who returned from Buckingham Palace to find his submarine with a crumpled nose, wasn't in the slightest upset about this, because he was all too happy to have a further fortnight in Belfast, which was quite a gay city in those days. Sorry, I used the wrong word, gay, there.
Gay in the old-fashioned sense of the word.
Gay in the old-fashioned, cheerful city. I then had a further period of spare CO, and in April 1941 took command of H-43, who was just completing a refit at Sheerness. Having got her out of the dockyard, we went round the north of Scotland to Tobermory, where we provided services for the Western Approaches escorts working up there under that redoubtable man, Monkey Stevenson. Life was always exciting when he was around, because you never knew what you might be told to do next, as he was a great one for keeping everybody right on their toes the whole time. But my stay in H-43 was not prolonged, because at the end of May I got a telephone call to say I was to join the mine-laying submarine Rorqual at Devonport in a week's time for passage out to Alexandria as spare commanding officer out in the first submarine flotilla based in Alex. I duly joined Rorqual, and we had an uneventful passage to Alexandria, where I arrived sometime about the end of June. There were three spare COs in Medway at the time, and I was detailed off to act as the assistant to the Staff Officer Operations, who controlled all the operations of the submarines belonging to that flotilla, who was at the time a commander always known as Harry Brown. I found this the most valuable time, because I had first-hand acquaintance with not only the commanding officers, but all other aspects of the conduct of submarine patrols in the Mediterranean. And I thoroughly enjoyed my virtually 2 months in the staff office in Medway. I was amongst a lot of old friends as well, and we were a very, very happy team, only marred by the continuing fairly high rate of loss of submarines failing to come back from patrol.
How did that affect morale?
I think it was accepted as just as fate, as we were at war, and you can't fight a war without losses, and one was saddened, of course, but I don't think it really lowered morale at all. Well, the next adventure was that Captain SM1 in Medway got a signal from Captain SM10 in Malta asking for a CO to be sent to take over command of Thrasher, which belonged to the 1st Flotilla but had been sent into Malta between patrols for the usual rest and replenishment period. And Captain SM10 thought that her then commanding officer was tired and really should be relieved. And so he asked SM1 to send a relief to Malta to take over. I was lucky enough to be the one spare CO who was around at the time, and I found myself that night flying to Malta in a Sunderland flying boat. An uneventful flight. I suppose it took about 6-7 hours in the dark. And on arrival next day in Malta, I found myself as commanding officer of HMS Thrasher.
Did you see much of the state of Malta at that time under siege?
Yes, one... Malta was very much under siege, although the major German bombing campaign had not really yet begun in October. This is October 41. There was fairly heavy bombing, and there was an awful lot of damage. You could see it in the dockyard, you could see it in Valletta, you could see it wherever you went, virtually. Buildings knocked down and so on, and air raids were fairly frequent.
Did you have much to do with the population, the Maltese themselves?
There were quite a lot of Maltese who worked in the submarine depot, which was shore-based, and of course the dockyard was entirely Maltese manned. And so one came across them quite a lot. And their spirits were really remarkably high and very pro-British, anti-Italian, and anti-German too. And there was no question of them ever wanting to be other than pro-British. Not that I found, anyway. Of course, they got frightened, as we all did, if you got a heavy bombardment from the air and houses falling down and your families being killed and so on. They did get upset, but they were not demoralized at all. And even later on in 42, when they were on very strict rationing and it was touch and go whether they could keep going just on food alone. I think they still maintained their morale in the most remarkable way. And I saw them then, because occasionally one dropped into Malta instead of going back